Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Well, we started the news roundup last Friday with bad news that Diane had fallen and cracked her pelvis. Well, we can start this week's news roundup with good news. She's doing well. We'll leave the hospital tomorrow to recuperate at home. She sends thanks to all of you for your good wishes. In Massachusetts yesterday, thousands of mourners lined the streets as the casket-carrying Ted Kennedy was moved from Hyannis to Boston. The Justice Department has opened an investigation into alleged CIA detainee abuses. And there are some encouraging signs for the U.S. economy. Joining me for the national hour of the Friday News Roundup, Dante Cheney, director of the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation blog, Jerry Seib, executive Washington editor of the Wall Street Journal, and Doyle McManus, Washington bureau chief of the Los Angeles Times. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number at 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, let's start with the legacy of Senator Ted Kennedy. He died, of course, late Tuesday night. He's now in repose, lying in repose at the JFK Library in Boston. The funeral is tomorrow. We expect all the living former presidents to be there and President Obama to deliver the eulogy. Jerry Seib, what do you think Senator Kennedy's legacy in Washington will be seen as?
Well, I think he was seen, will be seen as one of those people who made this remarkable journey from partisan divisive figure to great uniter. It's a remarkable story in its own way, and I think in some ways he was one of the last, you know, deal makers, uniters, guys who was seen as having the ability and the feel for how to pull both sides together at the end of a long and sometimes hard debate. That's what he became known as. That was the story of, I'd say, the last third of his Senate career. It's really a striking story if you think about how much he was not seen as that kind of figure at the beginning of his time in the Senate.
Well, Dante, what have you heard since his death in reactions from Americans?
Yeah, well, that's something that I do with this project. I'm always talking to people just kind of out there in these different communities. And, you know, it's a real mix. I mean, there are people who remember the Camelot years and see him as the last link to that. And there are some people who are going to miss him in terms of health care and what he could have and maybe been able to do in that area. But there's still, particularly among conservative communities, a lot of memories of things that happened, maybe didn't happen even, where there's still just a lot of anger. And in a way, it's funny because he progressed from being this strong liberal voice to being this uniter as the country actually kind of went the other way.
Yeah.
You know, Dora McManus, you are, of course, now a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. And I wonder, how different is Washington today from, and the U.S. Senate in particular, from the days when Ted Kennedy first moved here?
Oh, it's enormously different, Susan. And I think that's an overtone in the tributes and the nostalgia for Kennedy's career. You've heard very touching tributes from conservative Republican senators like John McCain and Orrin Hatch. And that was partly because, as Jerry and Dante have said, Kennedy was a deal maker who would work with across the aisle on legislation. And I would tweak their analysis a little bit because I think he managed somehow to be both a deal maker and a partisan, which was one of the secrets of his success. But that role was harder and harder to do because the Senate itself, like the House before it, has become much more polarized. There's a bunch of political scientists based at MIT who have actually done this in numbers. In 1980, when Kennedy ran for president, lost the nomination fight, and in effect turned to being the best senator he could be, about 40% of the senators were clumped in the middle. Now that number's about 10.
Makes it harder to make a deal these days.
That's
well,
right.
I remember it was almost exactly a year ago that Senator Kennedy went to the Democratic Convention in Denver, gave a speech that called health care the cause of his lifetime. Mm-hmm. Jerry Seib, what impact on this health care debate could sentiment for Senator Kennedy play?
You will hear people say now, this week, next week, and for a while, let's do it for Teddy. Let's do this for the Kennedy legacy. It was the cause of his lifetime. He was the guy who said, let's all come together and figure out a way to do this. I actually doubt that that's going to be the effect on the healthcare debate in the longer run. I think that will fade. I think we'll get to the harder political realities that the summer has revealed in this debate, and people will go back into their corners, and I suspect it'll be a passing. Maybe I'm wrong, but my strong instinct and my cynical instinct is it probably won't have much impact whatsoever.
Well, Dante, we saw the GOP unveil a health care bill of rights for seniors.
Right, yeah.
Well, tell us about that.
Well, if you wanted a sign of what Jerry was just talking about, you could see it in the health care bill of rights for seniors, which basically says a lot of things like, we'll keep the government out of the relationship you have with your doctors. There's nothing in the healthcare proposals right now. They won't interfere in the conversations you want to have with your physician about the end of your life, because obviously that's what's in there now, right? But it's not. A lot of things in this healthcare bill of rights, in fact, all of them, really, I don't think it really has any tie to what's in the bill. It's meant to drum up anger and you know, opposition among seniors, and judging from what you hear from people at these town hall meetings, it probably will have some kind of effect, because it's not really clear that people have any real understanding of what's in these bills.
You know, it's interesting, this debate has begun to focus on seniors when seniors are the part of the American population least affected by the health care proposals that are being discussed.
In theory, they're the ones least affected. But part of these bills, and of course, Obama still has the handicap that he doesn't have a bill. There are, what, four or five bills out there. There's a great big House bill. One of the parts of these bills, and one of the parts of Obama's own design, is that Medicare spending has to be reined in, and the savings from Medicare will be used to fund other parts of the plan. And that's got senior citizens nervous, because they don't know exactly what it means. Does it mean that their choices will be constrained? Does it mean that they won't be able to get the access they've had? Well, they're not sure. And in a funny way, there's an echo here of George W. Bush's drive for Social Security changes four years ago, when he told senior citizens, I'm not going to touch your benefits, and they didn't even want him looking at their Social Security. They don't even want to talk about it.
I go to all these places, and I talk to these different people, and one place I go is this community for seniors. It's emptying nest community. It's people, a lot of people 55 and over, a lot of retired people. Every place I went and talked to about health care reform, everybody was skeptical. Even, you know, some were more skeptical than others. But the strongest objections came from those people, people in those communities. Now, even though they may be the least affected, remember, they use the system a lot, and they don't want it touched. And they're the ones, they're angry.
You know, and there's something about Medicare that makes both parties just totally lose any sense of balance or equilibrium. I mean, here, the situation this week was that the Republicans were saying, in the person of their national chairman, we will do whatever we can to stop big government health care. Oh, by the way, we will defend Medicare to the nth. And Medicare is a big government health care program. Meanwhile, Democrats, who fought tooth and nail in 2006 when George W. Bush tried to make some more modest cuts in Medicare spending over the next 10 years, now proposing even bigger cuts in Medicare spending over the next 10 years and defending that to the hilt. So, you know, what is going on here, one asks sometimes.
Well, to complete the circle on Ted Kennedy, a controversy over how and when his seat will be filled. One of Senator Kennedy's last public letters, public communications, talked about his desire for the law in Massachusetts to be changed so that the governor there could immediately appoint a successor. Now, how did the governor lose that power, Dante? Yeah,
it's changed back, really, essentially. I mean, the way the law used to work was the governor would appoint a successor to the seat, but when John Kerry ran for president in 2004 and there was some hope that he would win, and his seat would have opened up in Massachusetts, Mitt Romney was the governor at the time, and they didn't want a Republican governor naming a successor to the seat, so the law was changed. They have 145 days after the seat is vacant to have a special election. Now they want it changed back, and you know, they're being called hypocrites by some. But the argument from the Democrats is, it's not about being hypocritical. This is a very important point in American history. We're dealing with these issues where we should have two votes, particularly on health care reform in the Senate. You know, it seems like the momentum is they're going to end up changing the law to do the appointment. But the question is, how quickly could that even happen? And what, you know, would it be 100 days before that happens?
Well, Doyle, do you think hypocrisy is a fair charge in this case?
It's absolutely a fair charge. But you know what? This is politics. Mm. It's situational morality is what it is.
You know, we had some good news this morning. Now, the news was from the Commerce Department that the gross domestic product declined at a 1% annual rate in the second quarter of the year. Now, you wouldn't ordinarily think that was good news, except that we thought it was going to decline 1.5%. So, Jerry, what do we make of this? Is this another sign that the economy is, in fact, turning around?
You have and have had this week a series of modestly good news events on the economic front, all of which suggest that a recovery is, or probably is at least, underway. I mean, you have even more newer news about consumer spending starting to creep up a bit, which was really one of the things people wondered about. Would people, consumers who drove the economic expansion in recent years, remain so hunkered down that they prevented a recovery? Well, maybe that's thawing out a little bit now. You had, as you said, a better economic growth number in the second quarter than people expected, certainly better than the drop of 6% in the previous quarter. And you had corporate profits starting to rise as well in the most recent weeks. And so all of those things together suggest consumers are crawling out of the foxhole a little bit, and employers may be crawling out of the foxhole a little bit, and that's what you need. It's still a long way back, but the signs are at least pointing in the right direction.
So do you think that we'll end up with growth in the third quarter, which might in fact mean that the recovery had begun?
We very well might end up with modest growth in the third quarter, and I think most people think certainly by the fourth quarter the signs point towards some very small growth. The number turns positive rather than negative, not by much, but a little bit.
Good news also in the housing industry, Dante. New home sales up 9.6% in July, the fourth month in a row we saw an improvement in that number.
Yeah, that's very important. I mean, when you go to some of these places out there, it's the housing market. It's also interconnected. The housing market, housing construction really drove the economies in these places. Housing construction collapses, people lose jobs, unemployment rises. So any improvement there is welcome.
We're going to take a very short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about deficit projections, which look a little less rosy. We'll continue our conversation on news of the week in the nation. We'll take your calls. Our phones are open, 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And joining me in the studio, Doyle McManus of the Los Angeles Times, Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, Dante Cheney of the Christian Science Monitor. You know, we were talking before the break about some encouraging news about the economy, but people who are looking for jobs may still have to wait a while, Doyle.
Well, I hate to rain on the parade of good news that Jerry and Dante brought up, but just about every forecaster still believes that unemployment is going to continue to rise for a whole variety of reasons, but of course basically because unemployment is always the last thing that gets fixed in a recovery. It's still going to go above 10% late this year or sometime next year, and that gloomy economist Nouriel Roubini actually wrote a piece saying this could turn out to be a W-shaped recovery. We could have a little brief recovery and then fall back to earth again. So don't go out and spend that money yet.
You know, you're defying the consumer confidence that Jerry was saying was so important for us to be looking at better times. Well, Jerry, there was some disquieting news this week with revised predictions of what kind of deficit and debt we're going to see over the next decade. What was reported?
In the short term, the picture actually got a little bit better. The estimates of the deficit this year went from $1.8 trillion a few months ago to a projection now of $1.5 trillion.
So why did it improve just a bit?
Well, in part because not as much money is going out to rescue banks and financial firms, and some money is coming back in, and also tax revenues because the economy is picking up maybe a little better than people thought. So a combination of reasons. But that looks to be in the margins when you step back and see the bigger picture. And what happened is that the long term, the 10-year deficit total that people are now projecting rose to $9 trillion. Between now and 2019, which is worse than people thought by about almost $2 trillion worse than was previously forecast. And that's because, as Doyle suggested, the recovery is probably going to be slow. It may be beginning, but it's going to be slow. But, and people should not forget this, this is, in the long run, this is very much tied to baby boomers retiring and soaking up more money for Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. It's why the only way to deal with this is, in the long run, is to get Medicare and Medicaid costs down, which is to get health care costs to start declining, at least stop increasing so much, and to come to terms with the Social Security costs of a whole generation of baby boom retirees. And nobody's talking about that right now.
You know, the deficit is often seems like a pretty abstract issue. But, Dante, when I go out and talk to people around the country, I hear a lot of concern about the amount of money being spent, the amount of red ink that we're piling up.
Yeah, I mean, well, what's a few trillion dollars, right? So $7 to $9 trillion. But I think it really resonates with people because they view this through their own lives. And, you know, they view it as like credit card debt for the government that the government has on its ledger that they see is, you know, the idea that it's $9 trillion a couple of years ago to be talking about that. That's remarkable.
And that they'll have to pay back.
That's the way they see it. And they think about their, you know, the American public is actually pretty decent at things, thinking about their children and what's coming down the pike for them. And also the effect this has on the healthcare debate. I mean, you know, that's a lot of red ink.
Doyle, what is the effect you think it will have on the healthcare debate?
Well, it has already had an effect on the healthcare debate. It has given Republicans another talking point about spending. It has given it should have given the Obama administration a strengthened talking point about its attempts to bring Medicare and other healthcare costs down over the long run. But that's been a very tough sale to make because that's looking forward. It's a projection. It involves that awful phrase, bending the curve. It's a lot easier to understand the idea that spending is going through the ceiling. You know, Dante talked about public opinion. A large part of the public looks at these numbers and thinks, gee, that's got to be Obama's great big stimulus package. Yeah. And the stimulus package is actually one of the smallest components of this deficit. It's these other long-term things and the economic sluggishness that's driving it up.
But it's the fact that he's asking for the health care bill, too. They're projecting that on Obama
exactly.
And saying, here he goes.
It's just a lousy time to ask for more money.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, we also saw President Obama start his vacation this week by appointing Ben Bernanke to another term as Federal Reserve Chairman. Any surprise there, Jerry?
No. I think the betting, certainly in the financial markets, and I think amongst most people who thought hard about this around Washington, was that a Bernanke reappointment was far more likely than not. The only surprise really was how soon President Obama did it. A lot of people thought he might wait until the fall. The current term doesn't actually end until the end of the year. I think the White House decided that having come to the conclusion the only thing that made sense in terms of sending a signal of stability and continuity was reappointing Ben Bernanke, why wait around and endure a couple of months of harmful speculation?
I thought that one reason might have also been to compete with the bad news about the deficit by getting some good news or some reassuring news for markets anyway about the reappointment of Ben Bernanke.
Yeah, I think most people would say Bernanke did a pretty good job ultimately of steering us through a very, very scary period. I mean, we look at these deficits now and the what's forecast, and it's scary, and that's a lot of money. But, you know, back in January, things really got kind of terrifying, I mean, as to where we could be heading. And the idea that we were able to rein all that, it took a lot of money, and not just the stimulus package, but all the TARP money. And the fact that we were able to rein that in and kind of, you know, we're at the point now where we're talking about the Dow is edging up again, corporate profits are rising. You know, it's he deserves some credit for that, and it's a reward, an early reward.
And by the way, you know, two things. The first of all, I think it would have been hard to paint a good news picture about how my team is winning the battle against the economic recession if you then were replacing one of the captains of the team. So I think there was a need to make the statement that Bernanke's doing a good job because we're doing a good job overall. Secondly, the one thing the president did get right, I noted this week, was He called the bottom of the stock market exactly right. The day in early March when he came out and said people essentially should be willing to invest in stocks again. It turns out that was on March 3rd. The bottom of the market was March 6th. He missed it by 2 days. If you'd invested on President Obama's advice, you'd be in great shape right now.
You mean he chose the wrong profession?
It's a possibility.
He will soon have a show on CNBC where he'll be calling the numbers.
Ben Bernanke could have a show on identity theft. You think of the Fed chairman as being pretty immune to the things that bother all of us, and yet we find out that a year ago, he and his wife were a victim of identity theft.
In the middle of the financial crisis. I mean, in the middle of trying to stave off collapse, Ben Bernanke's wife's purse was stolen from the back of a chair, I guess, in a coffee shop. And away went their checkbook and away went their credit cards. That's one nobody's immune from.
Let's read an email from Gene. He writes us from Miami. He says, I was sorry to hear Mr. McManus's comment on the partisan state of the Senate. I am further saddened that the voices of statesman senators such as Hatch, McCain, and Byrd, that's got a bipartisan ring with those three examples, will apparently not prevail upon the rest of the Senate to practice the skill of compromise and yet maintain their partisan identity. I believe that the public perception of the Congress as a whole is that party is placed well above national priorities and the country is worse off for it. Kennedy understood how to blend the two opposites. Sadly, it would appear that that skill will go to the grave with him. Do you think Gene is right to be so distressed by the current makeup of the Senate? Are there heirs to the kind of Kennedy tradition, the bipartisan tradition that Gene notes?
Well, there may be, but I think there are structural forces that have made the center sort of less populated, almost empty, in fact, in the political world in general and in the Senate in particular. You know, a generation ago, there were lots of senators who from both parties who sort of resided in the center, you know, Howard Baker, Sam Nunn, even Bob Dole at the end of his career. Well, take Georgia as an example. You know, Sam Nunn was a centrist because he came from a conservative state, Georgia. He was a Democrat, but he knew how to talk to conservatives because that's how you get elected in Georgia. Well, Georgia doesn't elect Democrats anymore. Both senators and the governor in Georgia are now Republicans. So there's no conservative Democrat from Georgia who knows how to talk to the other side. That on the other side of the aisle, New York State, I looked up this week, used to send lots of moderate Republicans to the House where they got together with moderate Democrats and formed a center. Well, in 1980, New York State sent 17 Republicans to the House. Last year, it sent 3. So there just aren't moderate Republicans, Democrats left to form these bridges in the middle. And that's nobody's fault in particular. It's the system and where the ideological divide has driven it.
I mean, look what happened to Arlen Specter. Arlen Specter, you know, his faced with the possibility he was going to face a more conservative option in the Republican primary, simply opted to become a Democrat. So I suppose he's still a moderate Democrat, you could say, instead of a moderate Republican. But
he may lose his job.
Yeah, right. But it's a sign that the middle is really has fallen apart.
Well, let's go to the phones. You can call us at 1-800-433-8850. We'll talk first to Jim. He's calling us from Jackson, Michigan. Jim, thank you for joining us.
Good morning. I wanted to try to dispel the notion that all senior citizens are just doddering old fools that don't understand that Medicare is part of a government program. When that poor woman said, I don't want the government messing with my Medicare, she was talking for all of us, meaning we don't want, you know, $500 billion cut from Medicare at our expense. We're well aware of it. I mean, we pay $100 a month nearly, each person, for Medicare. It irritates me that they take one quote from one woman at a town hall, and I've heard it repeated from every newsman up to and including the President of the United States. I doubt that's what she meant. 99% of the people that I talk to know fully well who funds Medicare.
All right, Jim, thanks for your call. Now, let me ask you, what do you hope happens on the health care debate?
I'm sorry?
Jim, what would you hope Congress does on this debate over health care? Do you want to see a bill passed or not?
The first thing that has to happen, we'll have to go back to work. That's where our emphasis and priority right now, not on.
All right, Jim, I'm sorry we've lost you. I think you must be on a cell phone. Well, have we unfairly maligned seniors here?
I think Jim is right on that point. I think that lady in that town meeting didn't express herself with the felicity that would make her an anchor woman on television. She knew that Medicare was a government plan, and she was expressing a desire to have nobody mess with her Medicare. And here is, this I think is really going to be the central battlefield in this issue this fall. That $500 billion number is one that Republicans have been very effective in getting out there. That's in the House bill, but it's not in every bill. The Obama administration number for taking money, trimming money from Medicare, is considerably smaller than that, and there is no final number. But the core of this is that Barack Obama and his Democrats, if they want to pass this, are going to somehow have to reassure senior citizens that their Medicare services will be intact after they find savings there. And they haven't succeeded in making that case yet.
But it is true that at these town hall meetings, seniors and others ask questions about things that are not part of this, any of these proposals, and never were.
I was going to say one thing that's probably unfair is to just hang this on seniors. There's just a lot of misunderstanding about what's really – I mean, it's true. There are multiple bills right now, and it's really hard to get a grasp, and it's been a real problem on what's going to happen. But, you know, the idea of what's really on the table, I think, is off right now.
Well, and I think this points to one of the problems the administration has backed into here, which is that the White House, the Obama administration, does not have a plan.
Right.
So that puts the president in the position of defending all kinds of things that other Democrats have put in various bills, some of which he may or may not believe strongly in, including a Medicare cut number that's bigger than the one the White House thought politically wise to begin with. Yet, because there's no plan that he can point to as his own, he's forced to defend whatever other Democrats are putting on the table. And that's a difficult position to be in.
And it makes it possible for opponents to talk about death panels or to complain about covering illegal immigrants who are not covered in the health care plans in ways that really take hold with some of the public imagination.
Yeah, it's – well, I don't know. This is kind of an Obama. This is the way Obama has seemed is I want all these opinions come to, and everything's, we're going to have a discussion about this. And what it does is, even if he doesn't have to defend all the proposals, he has to defend the idea that they're out there and they're part of the discussion, and it's difficult.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. Doyle.
I think Dante is right. It's, in a sense, it's as if the White House and the Democrats underestimated the opposition. They forgot the old military maxim that, you know, the enemy has a vote, too. One of my favorite arguments that has come up in the town halls, and that is fallacious, but that has a lot of resonance, you hear it often, is that people say, well, how come members of Congress have exempted themselves from this plan? And they ask their member of Congress, will you promise to put yourself under this plan? Well, actually, there's no provision that exempts members of Congress from the plan. You can't do that. Or they could conceivably do it, but they haven't done it. They're under the Federal Employees Insurance Plan, and under all the Democratic plans, they would stay exactly where they are. Why the Democrats haven't, you know, figured out a way to raise their hands and say, I promise that I will be in this plan and I'll write a provision in here that guarantees that, I don't know.
Congressman Jim Moran had a town hall this week in Virginia, and the question came up four times. And the reason it came up four times is the first time he was like, well, this is the way those works, and this is the way that health insurance works for congressmen and senators. And then the person was, I didn't get an answer. And I listened to it on the radio. It's possible if you watch it on television, it looked much more orderly. But on the radio, it sounded like chaos.
Let's go talk to Michael. He's calling us from Baltimore, Maryland. Michael, you're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Yes. There's so much going on that, like, the whole question of the deficit, the deficit that was in President Bush's proposal was, let's say, $1.2 trillion. Then there was talk about $1.8. Now is $1.6. And the president even put in figures from all kinds of expenditures which were kept out of the Bush budgets over the years. And it's completely neglected that basically it's the same. Instead of people in one year losing half their money in their 401s, they didn't lose a penny this year as of now. And also, even going back to 2001, the tax cuts were going to expire just completely, which, of course, was not the intention of the president or any Republicans in 2010. So these deficits were already set like a die. It would take great measures to turn it around.
All right, Michael, thanks so much for your call. Jerry, is it fair to say that this is really George Bush's deficit, or do you think Barack Obama also bears some responsibility for it?
Yes. look, I think a lot of apples and oranges are getting mixed up right now in the deficit debate. There's the short-term problem of how much the deficit will be this year, and that's fluctuated. It's when it was on its way to $700 billion when George Bush left and Barack Obama came in, probably because of financial sector bailouts and the cost of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. You've added on to that stimulus spending. The reality is that tax revenues will be down 17% this year because the economy is so slow, and spending will be up 24%. So that's why the deficit is what it is this year, and it's not as bad as we thought a few months ago, but it's still bad. The concern this week was really much more over the long-term deficit. What happens over the next 10 years? And that picture continues to get bleaker. That has something to do with spending that's going on right now, but it has more to do with the long-term costs of government programs in general, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security in particular.
Jerry Seib is Executive Washington Editor of the Wall Street Journal. And we're also joined this hour by Dante Cheney, Director of the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation blog, and Doyle McManus, a columnist with the Los Angeles Times. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll go back to the phones and we'll read some of your emails. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup of International Stories. Accusations of vote fraud mar the recent presidential election in Afghanistan. August is the deadliest month for U.S. troops there. And Japanese voters are expected to oust their once powerful ruling party. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. The Justice Department appointed a prosecutor this week to examine the CIA's interrogation program. Doyle McManus, this was something that President Obama had indicated he really did not want to see happen.
He did not want it to see happen, but his Attorney General, Eric Holder, apparently hadn't followed all of the literature on what the CIA interrogation techniques, which to most people turned out to look an awful lot like torture, what was going on there. And when he came to office, he asked to review the 2004 report of the CIA Inspector General. He was properly horrified by what he found there. It is a horrifying report. And he felt, as did many other lawyers in the Justice Department, that there ought to be one more review. The quick history of this is that there were, under that program, deaths of detainees in custody. There were acknowledged abuses where interrogators went beyond the rules they had been given. One of those cases was prosecuted. The rest of them were not prosecuted. They were handled administratively within the CIA. But the problem for Holder and for the Obama administration is the Justice Department that made those decisions in the Bush administration was a Justice Department that had made the rules and that didn't really want to come down on this plan. The argument here is for independent review.
Well, what is the argument, if that's the argument for the investigation, Dante, what is the argument against embarking on this investigation?
Well, I mean, the argument against that you're going to hear from folks who defended the practices is it's going to make us less safe in some ways because the FBI is going to be able to come in and tell and essentially rule on the techniques that were used, and you're going to have to, you know, it's the 24 argument, right? It's like, do you want Jack Bauer in there defending you? I mean, you don't want to know about it, but you want to keep the country safe, right? And if we're really going to do this stuff legally, are we still going to be safe anymore? That's going to be the argument against digging. You don't want to dig into something and see what's there because you'd just rather live without knowing, wouldn't you, really? That's the argument against it.
Where do you think public opinion is on this, Jerry?
You know, we did some public polling on this earlier in the summer, and there was a pretty deep divide in the public's mind. There was a big difference between people who wanted information and people who wanted prosecutions. People were much more interested in knowing than they were in seeing prosecutions occur. Now, that may have changed by the news of this week. I kind of doubt it, but it's possible. I think the political argument against going down this path is that there's not a lot of this report that has triggered all this is 5 years old. There's not a lot of new information on the table, and there's plenty of stuff to divide people in Washington right now. We've been talking about healthcare for some time now, and that's plenty divisive. Do you really want to add to the polarization and the partisanship in this environment? It gets in the way of doing other things. That's the political argument against going down this path.
I do think once the re-redacted report was released and everybody could see what was in it, I mean, you could have not gone forward with a special investigation, but it would have gotten pretty difficult
because some of the things that were described were pretty terrible.
They're troubling,
yeah, right?
Yeah, but Susan, I'm actually going to hazard something one shouldn't do—a prediction on how this comes out. Because I talked, as have other reporters, to John Helgerson, who was the Inspector General at the CIA who prepared the first report. There were about a dozen cases of abuse there. He said, Helgerson, that these are all borderline cases. At the end of the day, he would not recommend prosecution. My bet would be at most one or two of these might be referred for prosecution. This isn't a special prosecutor who has been charged to indict. It's a special prosecutor, or it's an existing prosecutor, a regular prosecutor who's been charged to review. So I suspect that's where this comes out.
You know, another argument I've heard about this is that this is an examination of people who are out in the field doing interrogations, and will also be held to account the lawyers who wrote opinions that set the rules that are now so controversial. Will the policymakers who were in charge also be held to account for what happened?
Yeah, it's the report. The term that was used in some of the reporting on it was clinical. When you looked at the rules that were set for this, were very the degrees to which the cold water that was put on people. Like what the temperature had to be, the amount of time for all these things. You know, this isn't just something that somebody came up with.
This is what's tricky about it, though, I think. If you're going to prosecute people for exceeding the rules, then you're implicitly saying the rules as
Absolutely.
Written by the Justice Department lawyers were fine. And I don't think the Obama administration wants to say that. So I think it's very tricky.
Yeah.
We also had news this week that a new elite group of interrogators would be created, but as part of the FBI, not the CIA. Now, this is causing enormous controversy here in Washington.
It's causing controversy, but oddly enough, Susan, it's made people at the CIA quite happy because they never wanted that job to begin with. And one of the reasons that this turned into such a mess was that the CIA had been out of the business of interrogation for a long time. They didn't have a corps of interrogators. They didn't have rules and doctrines and practices. They had to make it up on the fly. They only took the job on under protest because at the time, the FBI didn't want to do it. This is one of those jobs that nobody wants.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. We'll talk to Leslie. She's calling us from Falls Church, Virginia, here in the Washington area. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Thanks for calling.
Okay, anyway, I was at a healthcare debate this week with Howard Dean and Jim Moran in Reston, Virginia. And the most disturbances came from pro-life activists, which they finally threw out of the room. And the crowd was pretty much pro for the healthcare bill. And there were some people in there who were unemployed who were totally against the healthcare bill. What I can't understand is that I have health insurance. I'm being regulated what I can and can't do, even with health insurance. So it's hard for me to understand why these people are getting so crazy about this.
Did you find the town hall to be pretty useful? Do you think you learned some things?
Yes.
Or what did you think, Leslie?
Yes, I did. He started out debunking the myths that you were talking about earlier. And people were yelling to that and booing and saying, oh, you know. But I found it very informative as to debunking the myths. And Howard Dean, of course, was so informative because he's been through this with the, as a governor and in the state.
All right, Leslie, thanks for your call. Now, this must have been the town hall meeting you were talking about, Dante.
Yeah, it was actually really interesting the way they tried to do it. They had everybody submit questions beforehand. And you had to say whether you were pro, against, or undecided. And they put them in separate baskets, and then we're going to read one question from each of the baskets and walk through all of them so everybody gets an equal hearing. People said, is John Smith here? And somebody would step up to the microphone and say, I'm John Smith. And it wasn't John Smith. And there was yelling back and forth about that. I did not hear the whole thing. So if they had some of those people leave the room, it was probably a good idea. But it just sounded extremely chaotic. And I think that, you know, they tried to do a good job of explaining what was in the bills. And it's just a shame because there really should be a good debate, a legitimate debate on this. And I don't know if these town hall forums work terribly well when you have that kind of input.
Well, I think a lot of members of Congress were surprised when they went home and these town halls took off as forums, first for people who were mostly opposed. Now the people who supported have started to deliver their people to them as well. Have town halls played this role before, Jerry, that you can remember?
I can't think of a parallel, really. Nothing quite like this. And the surprise to me was having watched the Obama machine all through 2007 and 2008 and its ability to turn out people and to steer the debate was so far behind the curve compared to the conservative groups on this. It took them, as you said, I think there's a catch-up now, and now you have basically evenly divided crowds yelling at each other, I guess. But, you know, I was struck by how long it took the Obama and the liberal machine to gear up to fight this fight.
Actually, there is a distant echo in George W. Bush's Social Security plan, because when members of Congress went home to talk to their constituents, boy, they got a lot of blowback.
Or when in the 80s, I guess, and I think about it, you know, when there was an earlier attempt to deal with Social Security and Kraut swamped Dan Rostenkowski's car in Illinois and said, don't touch my Social Security. So I guess there are some precedents.
But part of the problem that the caller refers to is that this health care bill touches on so many other issues that haven't yet been resolved, and one of them is abortion. If there is a public option, government-run plan, would it cover abortions, even though it was run by the federal government with federal funding? Well, that's one that the Obama administration hasn't cleared up, but it's one that touches that hot-button issue, has divided the Catholic bishops. Yep. This one is such a nest of problems.
Well, what's the substantive answer? Would the public option plan, if it exists, cover abortions?
Well, you couldn't really have a public option plan you could have a public option plan that didn't cover abortion, unlike private insurance plans. One option that has been raised by some members of Congress is that you could somehow find private funding for that part of the plan and not have federal money used for it, but that's a very complicated thing.
Pretty murky.
Let's go to San Antonio, Texas, and talk to Dan. Dan, thanks for holding on.
Yeah, hello. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Say, I just had a quick comment. It's actually, you guys were talking about economic recovery indicators earlier in the show. And I'm a truck driver. I travel over the 48 states and into Canada. And I think the easiest indicator that the public can look at as far as whether the economy is on a rebound is simply look at the volume of tractor trailers out on the road. If you see an increased number of these rigs out there and a decreased number in the ones that are parked at these different truck stops, chances are the economy is going to be following suit pretty shortly. And for me personally, since late February, I've had an increase in the number of average miles per week. So I, on my end, I can definitely see a slight recovery in the economy. And I'd like to know what you guys think about that and if you guys are looking at those simple numbers.
Okay, Dan, thanks so much for your call. So a trucker's index, along with the housing index and others, what do you think,
Well,
Jerry?
Look, I mean, I spent some time in the last week driving up and down Interstate 95, and I saw plenty of trucks standing in my way.
Especially New Jersey, right?
New York and New Jersey, especially in Connecticut. So anyway, Dan may have a point. You know, one of the interesting things about Alan Greenspan's time at the Fed was he found fascinating little previously unobserved economic indicators that he paid attention to. This sounds like as good a one as any.
That's right. Alan Greenspan used to look at the volume of cardboard boxes being produced because
that's
a big
indicator.
How much shipping was going on. Yeah. But here's the problem for Dan. Is this just a bounce back because at the bottom people were working through their inventory? That's one of the things that's happened in automobiles. At some point, people were going to have to start buying cars again because their old cars were wearing out. So we don't know yet how strong that signal is.
And one thing, it's fascinating. That's actually the kind of indicator I'd love to track on the Patchwork Nation site. The one thing I'd really like to know is where are the trucks going? because it'd be interesting to see the places that are seeing more truck traffic first rather than later.
We'll go to Charlotte, North Carolina and talk to David. David, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
One thing that has also come out in the CI Inspector General's report was some more detail about how Congress was briefed on the enhanced interrogation technique. And that, Nancy Pelosi knew about this stuff. Leadership of the Congress in the Senate and the House knew what the CIA was doing, were told about specific techniques. And this has not been reported in the media by anyone.
Okay,
and it is in the Inspector General's report. And one more thing, if I could.
Mm-hmm, sure.
I think that, when Mr. McManus was talking about people not wanting to do interrogations, what's going on right now is the reason why, is that some administration is going to come in behind them, and these guys, whether they get prosecuted or not, they're going to have to lawyer up, and God knows how many thousands of dollars they're going to have to spend in legal fees.
All right. David, thank you for your call. I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Now, this controversy over what kind of briefing Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker of the House, and previously as a member of the Intelligence Committee, had received, that's been around for some time. Is there new light on that issue in the Inspector General report? Anybody know?
I was unaware of it, if there is.
Yeah. I think the facts that are on the table on this subject as well as the other, or have been there before. I think it's a question of what do they mean? What does she knew? What does they knew mean? What's the meaning of knowing? And that, I mean, Nancy Pelosi waded into a swamp on this a few months ago, and I don't think she's ever entirely gotten out of that.
David, I'm sorry that none of us know more to discuss this issue. Perhaps it's something we'll address later in a later Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Charles. He's calling us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Charles, good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to address the health care issue. First of all, the funding, it would seem as if with the Bush tax cut for the rich being eliminated and winding down in Iraq, which is $120 billion a month, I would think that we'd have enough funding for it. Also, why can't we just eliminate the true welfare queens in America, the farm industry, which we subsidize and impoverish Americans with our prices, and we impoverish the developing farmers of the world, or the developing world, who can't compete because of it. For one thing. And also, I keep hearing over and over that the majority of Americans and people I speak to are in favor of a single-payer system. But everybody acknowledges that that just can't pass in Congress, which would seem to me to speak highly of some electoral funding reform. If the lobbyists have much more control than anyone in America wants them to have, and everybody in Congress seems to say they can't help it, they won't get reelected unless they go along with the lobbies, and why can't we address that issue again?
You know, Charles, a good point. We wanted to discuss just briefly the indictment of a well-known Democratic fundraiser this week. Who was he, Jerry?
He was an Iranian-American businessman who has given lots of money for a long time to lots of politicians from both parties. His name is Hassan Namazi. He was indicted for fraudulently obtaining a loan from Citigroup, and that sort of opened the doors to the long lists of politicians, starting with President Obama and Vice President Biden, all the way down, mostly Democrats, but including some Republicans he's donated to over the years. Many of those politicians now rushing to say, I'll give the money back to somebody.
should politicians be expected to know whether the donors they're accepting money from and who are doing fundraising from them, should they be expected to know whether they're honorable people?
Yes, they should. And this comes up almost every election cycle. Actually, then-Senator Hillary Clinton had this problem in her presidential campaign, not with Namazi, but with other donors whom she had to disavow because they were collecting money in illegal ways.
There's just so much out there. There's so much money that flows in these campaigns. It would be nice if they – it would be nice for them to vouch for them. I just – it's hard to imagine how that can happen.
Dante Cheney of the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation blog, Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, and Doyle McManus of the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for joining us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.